This is a CBS News special report. President Richard M. Nixon speaks to the nation. I'm Neil Strauser with my colleague, CBS News White House correspondent Robert Pierpoint, reporting on the CBS radio network. 6 years ago this evening, August 8, 1968, the scene was the Republican National Convention in Miami Beach, and Richard Nixon was triumphantly accepting his party's presidential nomination.
America's in trouble today not because her people have failed, but because her leaders have failed. And what America needs are leaders to match the greatness of her people.
And, of course, Mr. Nixon went on to win the presidency in 1968 and again in 1972. But tonight, the triumph appears to have ended, and there may be a new leader. The rapid march of events, which began on Monday when Mr. Nixon announced that he concealed evidence of an early role in the Watergate cover-up, seems, Robert Pierpoint, to lead to only one conclusion. That President Nixon, when he speaks in about 5 minutes, will announce that he is becoming the first man to resign the presidency of the United States.
That's right, Neil. There isn't any real doubt here as to what the president is going to do. He is going to announce tonight his resignation. We're not exactly sure of all of the details. They've been worked out during the day. We don't think the resignation will take effect until sometime tomorrow. Legally, as you know, it has to be handed in letter form to the Secretary of State, and we understand that that will happen tomorrow while the president and some members of his family are on an Air Force plane on their way to California. At least that is the plan that we have been told the president has been drawing up, so that by the time he lands in California, the letter of resignation will be in the hands of the Secretary of State. Officially, the new president will be sworn in shortly thereafter. All that, as far as we can tell now, will take place tomorrow.
Be the president's mood at this time, Bob?
We have not seen the president all day. We can't really be sure. Obviously, whatever he feels, he is a very strong person. He's keeping it pretty much to himself. One of our correspondents, Connie Chung, did talk about that very subject of the president's mood with Stephen Bull, one of the president's aides, about an hour and a half ago. And Connie, what did Steve Bull have to say?
Bull has seen the president, and he said the president is, quote, unbelievably serene. Although Bull would not definitely say that the president had decided to resign, he said that the president had no second thoughts about his decision. He called the president's mood distraught yesterday, but not today. He said the president was disturbed yesterday when he was agonizing over his decision. He called the president somewhat placid, but he said he's an amazing man because he has come to this decision and is sticking with it. Bull was asked what he plans to do, and he said he will stick with the president as long as he wants him around, as long as he needs him. And he said he would go to California with the president tomorrow, along with Presidential Press Secretary Ronald Ziegler.
I suppose, Bob, that the day of Vice President Ford would also be a good tip-off on what's going to happen. Of course, he met with Mr. Nixon this morning. Immediately thereafter, canceled a Western swing, met with his top aides. He met with Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, and issued a statement thereafter through his press spokesman, which seemed to be aimed at assuring the nations of the world that he will support the Nixon foreign policy.
Which is, of course, very important at this particular juncture. We're always concerned that our adversaries might strike in some way at the United States while the United States is in a moment of transition or crisis. I would like to point out one other thing, and that is that the new press secretary is going to be replacing Mr. Ziegler, will be working for Gerald Ford as president, will be a gentleman from Detroit named Jerry Terhorst, about whom the American public is going to be hearing much in the next days and weeks. Mr. Terhorst is planning to meet with Mr. Ziegler here tonight, and that part of the transition is already underway.
And of course, there are questions as to who will be the new vice president under Gerald Ford. CBS News asked Republican Senator Charles Percy if he would take the job.
Of course, I have every reason to believe every other single person on any list he may have would accept readily. I can't imagine any American turning him down now for any post that he should ask them to undertake to help bring this country together again.
And that was Charles Percy, who is said to be on the list of 14 drawn up by Ford staff. We pause now 5 seconds for station identification.
Listening to KRLD Dallas. 1080 on the dial.
This is Neil Strozer with Robert Pierpoint, CBS News, Washington. Shortly, President Nixon will speak. CBS News will offer a summary and analysis following the address. Also standing by is Leslie Stahl at the home of Vice President Ford. He may make an informal appearance following the speech. And in New York, standing by are correspondents Reed Collins and Charles Osgood with their observations and reaction from around the country and the world to what we expect to hear, that President Nixon is resigning. The president is said to have been working on this speech up to the last minute. There is no advance text available. We hear only that the address will last 15 or 20 minutes. Mr. Nixon will speak from the Oval Office in the White House. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Good evening. This is the 37th time I have spoken to you from this office, where so many decisions have been made that shaped the history of this nation. Each time I have done so to discuss with you some matter that I believe affected the national interest. In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation. Throughout the long and difficult period of Watergate, I have felt it was my duty to persevere, to make every possible effort to complete the term of office to which you elected me. In the past few days, however, it has become evident to me that I no longer have a strong enough political base in the Congress to justify continuing that effort. As long as there was such a base, I felt strongly that it was necessary to see the constitutional process through to its conclusion, that to do otherwise would be unfaithful to the spirit of that deliberately difficult process, and a dangerously destabilizing precedent for the future. But with the disappearance of that base, I now believe that the constitutional purpose has been served, and there is no longer a need for the process to be prolonged. I would have preferred to carry through to the finish, whatever the personal agony it would have involved. And my family unanimously urged me to do so. But the interests of the nation must always come before any personal considerations. From the discussions I have had with congressional and other leaders, I have concluded that because of the Watergate matter, I might not have the support of the Congress that I would consider necessary to back the very difficult decisions and carry out the duties of this office in the way the interests of the nation will require. I have never been a quitter. To leave office before my term is completed is abhorrent to every instinct in my body. But as president, I must put the interests of America first. America needs a full-time president and a full-time Congress, particularly at this time with problems we face at home and abroad. To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the president and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow. Vice President Ford will be sworn in as president at that hour in this office. As I recall the high hopes for America with which we began this second term, I feel a great sadness that I will not be here in this office working on your behalf to achieve those hopes in the next 2.5 years. But in turning over direction of the government to Vice President Ford, I know, as I told the nation when I nominated him for that office 10 months ago, that the leadership of America will be in good hands. In passing this office to the Vice President, I also do so with a profound sense of the weight of responsibility that will fall on his shoulders tomorrow, and therefore of the understanding, the patience, the cooperation he will need from all Americans. As he assumes that responsibility, he will deserve the help and the support of all of us. As we look to the future, the first essential is to begin healing the wounds of this nation, to put the bitterness and divisions of the recent past behind us, and to rediscover those shared ideals that lie at the heart of our strength and unity as a great and as a free people. By taking this action, I hope that I will have hastened the start of that process of healing which is so desperately needed in America. I regret deeply any injuries that may have been done in the course of the events that led to this decision. I would say only that if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made in what I believed at the time to be the best interest of the nation. To those who have stood with me during these past difficult months, to my family, my friends, to many others who joined in supporting my cause because they believed it was right, I will be eternally grateful for your support. And to those who have not felt able to give me your support, let me say, I leave with no bitterness toward those who have opposed me. Because all of us, in the final analysis, have been concerned with the good of the country, however our judgments might differ. So let us all now join together in affirming that common commitment and in helping our new president succeed for the benefit of all Americans. I shall leave this office with regret at not completing my term, but with gratitude for the privilege of serving as your president for the past 5.5 years. These years have been a momentous time in the history of our nation and the world. They have been a time of achievement in which we can all be proud. Achievements that represent the shared efforts of the administration, the Congress, and the people. But the challenges ahead are equally great, and they too will require the support and the efforts of the Congress and the people working in cooperation with the new administration. We have ended America's longest war, but in the work of securing a lasting peace in the world, the goals ahead are even more far-reaching and more difficult. We must complete a structure of peace so that it will be said of this generation, our generation of Americans, by the people of all nations, not only that we ended one war, but that we prevented future wars. We have unlocked the doors that for a quarter of a century stood between the United States and the People's Republic of China. We must now ensure that the one quarter of the world's people who live in the People's Republic of China will be and remain not our enemies, but our friends. In the Middle East, 100 million people in the Arab countries, many of whom have considered us their enemy for nearly 20 years, now look on us as their friends. We must continue to build on that friendship so that peace can settle at last over the Middle East, and so that the cradle of civilization will not become its grave. Together with the Soviet Union, we have made the crucial breakthroughs that have begun the process of limiting nuclear arms. But we must set as our goal not just limiting, but reducing and finally destroying these terrible weapons so that they cannot destroy civilization, and so that the threat of nuclear war will no longer hang over the world and the people. We have opened a new relation with the Soviet Union. We must continue to develop and expand that new relationship so that the two strongest nations of the world will live together in cooperation rather than confrontation. Around the world, in Asia, in Africa, in Latin America, in the Middle East, there are millions of people who live in terrible poverty, even starvation. We must keep as our goal turning away from production for war and expanding production for peace, so that people everywhere on this earth can at last look forward in their children's time, if not in our own time, to having the necessities for a decent life. Here in America, we are fortunate that most of our people have not only the blessings of liberty, but also the means to live full and good, and by the world's standards, even abundant lives. We must press on, however, toward a goal not only of more and better jobs, but of full opportunity for every American. And at what we are striving so hard right now to achieve, prosperity without inflation. For more than a quarter of a century of public life, I have shared in the turbulent history of this era. I have fought for what I believed in. I have tried, to the best of my ability, to discharge those duties and meet those responsibilities that were entrusted to me. Sometimes I have succeeded, and sometimes I have failed. But always, I have taken heart from what Theodore Roosevelt once said about the man in the arena whose face is marred by dust and sweat and blood, who strives valiantly, who errs and comes short again and again, because there is not effort without error and shortcoming, but who does actually strive to do the deed, who knows the great enthusiasms, the great devotions, who spends himself in a worthy cause, who at the best knows in the end the triumphs of high achievements, and who at the worst, if he fails, at least fails while daring greatly. I pledge to you tonight that as long as I have a breath of life in my body, I shall continue in that spirit. I shall continue to work for the great causes to which I have been dedicated throughout my years as a congressman, a senator, vice president, and president. The cause of peace, not just for America, but among all nations. Prosperity, justice, and opportunity for all of our people. There is one cause, above all, to which I have been devoted, and to which I shall always be devoted. When I first took the oath of office as president 5.5 years ago, I made this sacred commitment to consecrate my office, my energies, and all the wisdom I can summon to the cause of peace among nations. I've done my very best in all the days since to be true to that pledge. As a result of these efforts, I am confident that the world is a safer place today, not only for the people of America, but for the people of all nations. And that all of our children have a better chance than before of living in peace rather than dying in war. This, more than anything, is what I hoped to achieve when I sought the presidency. This, more than anything, is what I hope will be my legacy to you, to our country, as I leave the presidency. To have served in this office is to have felt a very personal sense of kinship with each and every American. In leaving it, I do so with this prayer. May God's grace be with you in all the days ahead.
And so Richard M. Nixon has announced that he will become the first president to resign his office. Beginning his speech, his voice broke slightly when he said, "In all the decisions I have made in my public life, I have always tried to do what was best for the nation." His voice became stronger as he continued. He said he became convinced he no longer had the political base in the Congress to carry on. Without that base, he said, the constitutional process has been served and there was no need to carry through with the impeachment process, much as he would prefer to. And then came the words that will live in our history.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Mr. Nixon said, "I feel a great sadness. I will be not here in this office working on your behalf the next 2.5 years, but I know the leadership of America will be in good hands, those of now Vice President Ford." Mr. Nixon said, "By taking this action, I hope I will have hastened the start of that process of healing in America." Then came his only direct reference to the Watergate charges. "I would say only if some of my judgments were wrong, and some were wrong, they were made at the time in what I believe to be the best interests of the nation." Mr. Nixon said he's eternally grateful to those who stood with me. He leaves with no bitterness for those who opposed me. And much of the remainder of his address was devoted to his search for peace in his 5.5 years in office. Robert Pierpoint, are you there from the White House?
Neil, that was probably the most moving speech that Richard Nixon has ever made or ever will make. He was obviously moved himself, and yet, as he has said many times, in the period of a crisis, once the decision is made, then the tensions go, and you can proceed to do what has to be done, and that's what he demonstrated tonight. There were tensions, of course. His face twisted at times, and his voice broke as he said some of the words that were so hard for him to say. Nevertheless, he said them. There were some things that he did not say, of course. He did not in any way concede that he had committed any crimes. He did not even imply that he had himself done anything wrong, only that his judgments were wrong. And even then, he said, any judgments that were wrong were made in what he believed to be the best interests of the nation. But one probably could not have expected President Nixon at this stage to concede any wrongdoing. On the other hand, one might not have expected him to make as many fine points as he did make. He said he had no bitterness, and he showed none in this address tonight. Perhaps one of the most emotional moments came when he said he was never a quitter, and that what he was having to do was abhorrent to every instinct in his body. And at that point, he appeared to feel in every part of his body that abhorrence for what he was doing because he had to. It's very interesting to me that he laid this problem on the basis of Congress not being willing to give him political support. Obviously, The point at which he made the decision, and there's been much discussion about this in these last two or three days, but the point at which he made the decision was precipitated by the news brought to him yesterday afternoon by those three members of Congress from the Republican Party who came down to see him, Senator Scott, Senator Goldwater, and Congressman Rhodes. And I believe it was Senator Goldwater who pointed out to the president that if his case went to trial, if the impeachment was voted by the House and he was tried in the Senate, he could not expect more than 15 votes of support. That must have been the final blow to the president. And that, I believe, is why he said tonight there was no longer a political base in the Congress. And that's why he did what he was doing tonight. Now, one other important point, I think he went out, in a sense, with his flag flying when he enumerated the many things he's done in the field of foreign affairs. And I think that he believes, and he may very well be right, that history will view him somewhat differently than we do now because of his accomplishments in the field of foreign affairs. Altogether, Neil, it was a gracious farewell.
Bob, eight presidents have previously died in office. This is the first one to announce he will resign. Yet I suppose, in a way, you could say that this is the constitutional process of peaceful change at work as well.
Neil, I think that while there may be a great deal of sadness around the country at the moment, there are many people who did not want to see this moment ever come. At the same time, we must look at this as proof, living proof, that our Constitution works, that our democracy is a success, that the impeachment clause of the Constitution was written with good purpose, and it served its purpose. Now, it's true that the impeachment clause was not seen through to its end. There was no need for that. The president resigned rather than face conviction in the Senate. But the fact is that he would not have resigned had not the constitutional clause been there, which was being invoked. The process of peaceful change, we have now proven, is possible. And I think, in a sense, this is a very good thing for the country. After all, despite the very fine speech that he gave tonight, it has been proven to just about everyone's satisfaction that the president did more than make wrong judgments. The House Judiciary Committee, almost to a man, now believes he committed wrongs himself. And now the peaceful change is taking place in power. And that is a very, very important plus in a democracy as large and as diverse as ours, or in any nation as large and as powerful and as diverse as ours. Change is difficult, and it brings upheavals. In many cases, it brings danger, and even worse. But in this case, in the United States, that is not happening. And I think that, frankly, I'm encouraged by seeing the process working the way it is.
Bob, we must remind ourselves what precipitated this resignation. Even though the House Judiciary Committee had completed work last week on three proposed articles of impeachment, it was the release this Monday of those three tapes made with H.R. Haldeman 6 days after the Watergate break-in that precipitated, when those tapes show President Nixon talking of the political advantages of limiting the FBI investigation, which was at least delayed for a few days, although Mr. Nixon went on to point out that the FBI did complete its investigation shortly thereafter. But the question is raised, I think, by his speech. On Capitol Hill this day, a number of legislators worried about how to ensure that Mr. Nixon will not face prosecution after he leaves office. And Republican Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts introduced a sense of the Senate resolution which would urge immunity from Mr. Nixon. But even Brooke said that Mr. Nixon should make some kind of confession of error.
When I introduced the resolution on immunity for the president today, I said that I would want full confession from the president of his involvement in Watergate and all related incidents. I think the American people are entitled to know all of the facts, and I think the president must make a clean breast of it. And when he does resign from office, I would agree that he certainly should not say that I'm resigning, but I'm not guilty of any offense.
The Democratic leadership, Bob, as we know, for various reasons, opposed that resolution. For instance, the assistant Democratic leader of the Senate, Robert Byrd of West Virginia.
In my judgment, it would be an intrusion upon the constitutional powers of the judiciary and the executive. Moreover, I think it would be a very bad precedent for Congress to initiate.
Senator Mike Mansfield, the Democratic leader, said that he thought such a resolution would seem a nudge to get Mr. Nixon to resign. Now, Bob, I think no one wants to see a former president in jail. I'm not sure if those who want the record set straight for history will be totally satisfied with the speech tonight or not.
Neil, there are going to be people who are going to be quite critical about the fact that the president didn't confess any wrongdoing tonight. Senator Brooke has a point, and the fact is that Mr. Nixon did not confess any wrongdoing tonight. He only said he might have made some wrong judgments. In fact, he said there were some wrong judgments. I didn't expect him to make a confession tonight. I just don't think that a man in his situation really could do that at this time. Now, the future is another matter. We do have laws in this nation, and we are a nation of laws and not of men. And there are many people who believe, and I believe that Speaker Carl Albert indicated just the other day this very fact, that if the president has committed wrongs and it turns out he's committed crimes, maybe he should stand before a tribunal for those crimes. Now, retribution, no. Vindication or vindictiveness, no. But at the same time, there has been a lot of damage caused by Watergate. There has been an erosion in many respects of the faith of a lot of people in our democratic process. Perhaps the resignation will help restore some of that. But the country has been hurt by Watergate. And I think it's a fair point to say that we're going to have to all, as American citizens, take a look at this situation, not on the emotion of tonight, not in the heat and the bitterness of what we may feel at the moment, but in terms of the long-range future of the country, to decide whether, in fact, the president might not have to answer for some of the things that went on under his jurisdiction.
There's a fear on the part of some Democrats, and I should say some Republicans, too, that if there isn't some statement of what they feel is the record on Watergate made plain, and that obviously now will not be made plain through an impeachment proceeding, perhaps through reports of the Judiciary Committee and so forth, but if that isn't made plain, that in time, some fear that the opinion will be that the president was hounded out of office by the news media and by partisan people, and that the case will not become known to history.
Neil, there is that fear, you're right, but on the other hand, it seems to me that anyone who has the opportunity to read the record, that is to get a look at the transcripts, to see what the House Judiciary Committee did, saw, and heard, you know, the facts are there, and those men were, in the beginning, not at all anxious to have Mr. Nixon impeached, and after they went through the facts carefully, they made the unhappy decision that he had to be impeached, and finally all 38 of them agreed with that, so that there are going to be people in this country who would not care what the facts were, would not be interested in hearing about the facts. They don't want impeachment of a president. They don't want the resignation of Richard Nixon under any circumstances.
But, Bob, we, of course, now have the resignation impending, at least. As of noon tomorrow, the president, with Gerald Ford, to become the 38th president of the United States. And to help us along with observations on these momentous events, let's bring in, from New York, correspondents Reed Collins and Charles Osgood.
Well, Charles, you and I sat here, and we listened to it, as did our colleagues in Washington. The speech clocks out to about 15 minutes and 15 seconds. I noted that I believe an elocutionist would have appreciated the delivery. Hardly a slip, maybe one about 9.5 minutes deep on the Soviet Union. But it was a speech unlike, I think, some of Mr. Nixon's previous addresses that tended to run past the optimum length. Probably about right if there is a standard for this kind of thing, which is unique in itself, isn't it?
Yes, it is, Reed, and I think that, as our colleagues in Washington have pointed out, that this may be the most moving speech that President Nixon has ever made or will ever make. It was moving. It was a statesmanlike kind of a speech. It showed no bitterness and no rancor whatever to his political enemies. There was none of the Richard Nixon of 1960. No Nixon to kick around anymore. Nothing of that sort.
I thought if you really wanted to hear the nub of it, the first 60 seconds got it done. He said he thought he had the duty to persevere, to complete the term of office. But within the first minute, he had said that this was impossible because, in a lawyer's legalistic sense, his political base had disappeared. He did not put his neck in the noose that Senator Brooke had suggested, with the implied promise that the Senate somehow would then take it back out for him or destroy the noose, which I think most lawyers would have been reluctant to do, leaving the office and not knowing what grand juries in Washington, D.C. might decide to do, or what individuals who felt they had some legal shows in action might decide to do. That full confession idea probably would not sit well with anybody who had any legal background.
I believe that many Americans may be wondering, well, what happens now? The president is going to San Clemente tomorrow. He's not going to be at the White House to attend the ceremony for the swearing-in of Gerald Ford as the 38th president. There is, we understand, a brief ceremony planned tomorrow. It's going to be private, at which the president will say goodbye to his White House staff. And then he'll be getting on a helicopter and he'll be going over to Andrews Air Force Base and flying from there to California. At some point during that flight, he will cease to become president, because the 38th president will be sworn in while he's en route, and when he gets off the plane in California, he'll be Richard Nixon, private citizen.
I imagine the temptation to look at one's watch around noontime Eastern Daylight Time will be pretty strong as the president and his family fly west. Well, despite the resignation, details of which we have just heard, and the fact of it, we have heard that the president still faces some legal difficulties, as we have sort of hashed about here, and CBS correspondent Fred Graham takes a closer look at some of those problems.
He's got a lot of legal problems. It's unprecedented, of course, for a president to get in legal difficulty in the first place. We've never had one that's had these problems, and it was rather unnatural what happened, because Richard Nixon had the immunity of the office. He couldn't be prosecuted. He couldn't be sued. He couldn't be called as a witness personally. He, of course, was subpoenaed for papers. All that's stripped away now. He can now be subpoenaed to testify in person. There will be an effort to disbar him. State and local prosecutors could attempt to name him as a defendant in some of these cases, although I doubt that would happen. And he can be sued. Daniel Ellsberg at one time talked about the possibility of suing the president because of the burglary of his psychiatrist's office. There was some talk that some of these people who were illegally wiretapped might name the president. They didn't while he was president. They could add him now as a defendant. So he could become enmeshed in a whole web of legal difficulties that could make his life very unpleasant for years to come.
Well, as Fred points out, Charles, he could be sued. From what we read and hear, Mr. Nixon is almost judgment-proof, however, owing the amounts of money that he does in some pyramided mortgages. I believe he hasn't met the last one completely on San Clemente. And so all of these things are, of course, one of those legal entanglements, and many people, I think, for reasons of a variety, probably might like to take that course of legal action. But Mr. Nixon, I think, stands to have some income. Our colleagues in Washington, I think, know a little more about this, but theoretically, this will save the $60,000 annual ex-presidential pension. I believe there's another $96,000 involved, is there not, in running the office? And then maybe some other pension money that will pile on top of that. The Civil Service Commission will have to decide what an ex-vice president, congressman, and senator has accrued. Is anybody there familiar with that, Neil, or Robert?
Yes.
Address myself to that, Reed. The fact is, you're quite correct. First of all, under the present laws, the president is eligible for $60,000 a year in pension, at least $96,000 a year in expenses for staff and stationery and equipment and that kind of thing, and that does not include office space. He'll get that for free. He has a $20,000 a year pension for Mrs. Nixon when he passes on as a widow's pension for all former presidents' wives. And in addition to that, I think it's fair to point out that he also has very valuable property. Now, it's true that at the moment he's a little cash poor. That is, if he sells his land in San Clemente or any parts thereof, and I think he could sell some of the land around the mansion without selling the mansion itself, that is very valuable land. Several acres of it there. He may not be able to do that because of the local restrictions, but he does not have to keep that San Clemente mansion. It is worth, I would estimate, well over $1 million. Secondly, he has $500,000 at least in property down in Key Biscayne. So that, and now, mind you, he would have lost the income from pensions and from the emoluments of being an ex-president if he had been convicted and removed from office. He still would have had the property. But all of this taken together, he's not going to come out of this a poor man, and I don't think that we ought to push that point too far. And I doubt very seriously that courts are going to judge him guilty in the sense that he's going to have to pay out a lot of money in lawsuits. I doubt very seriously that that's going to happen. I think the real problem the president faces is the one of criminal prosecution. And we've discussed this at some length. Fred gave you some interesting views on it a little while ago, but there's one other thing I'd like to point out, and that is, in talking to Fred and others, it seems the simplest way for the president to be freed of criminal prosecution is for President Ford, when he takes office, to grant a pardon for all crimes the president may have committed. And he doesn't even have to be brought before any courts to have that pardon given to him across the board. Now, this is a little difficult for Ford, because one time he was asked this very question when he was being heard before the Senate Judiciary Committee. What would happen if you became president and Mr. Nixon was convicted of crimes? Would you pardon him? And he said something about, well, I don't think the American public would stand for that. Now, however, the vice president, who will soon be president, is faced with just that kind of problem. And what it seems to me may happen is that the Congress of the United States could vote a resolution of immunity which has no legal force, but which would be a sense of the Congress that he should be pardoned. And in that case, the Congress, speaking as the representatives of the people, could in effect say to the president, President Ford, we think that the people want the president pardoned. That is probably the best and simplest way that he can escape any possible future criminal prosecution.
Reed and Charles and Bob, we should note that just about 15 minutes before Mr. Nixon went on the air, the White House issued a set of the last official photographs taken of the first family. And one of them showed President Nixon holding his daughter, Julie Eisenhower. She's overcome with sobs on the eve of his resignation from the presidency. The pictures were taken by the official White House photographer, Ollie Atkins. And, of course, those were highly emotional moments. The president, we were told, was serene this last day, and he certainly was in his speech, but his family was quite overcome at his decision to leave the presidency. And now the man who's to assume the presidency is outside his house. We go to Leslie Stahl.
Ladies and gentlemen, the Vice President of the United States. I think that this is one of the most difficult and very saddest periods, and one of the very saddest incidents that I've ever witnessed. Let me say that I think the President of the United States has made one of the greatest personal sacrifices for the country and one of the finest personal decisions on behalf of all of us as Americans by his decision to resign as President of the United States. It's been my opportunity to watch over a period of nearly 25 years, a foreign policy in the last 5 years that has been most successful in the achievement of peace for all of us here and hopefully the rest of the world. It's been a policy that I think can continue peace in the months and years ahead. Let me say without any hesitation or reservation that the policy that has achieved peace and built the blocks for future peace will be continued, as far as I'm concerned, as President of the United States. We've been fortunate in the last 5 years to have a very great man in Henry Kissinger who has helped to build the blocks of peace under President Nixon. I think those policies should be continued. And those policies of peace will be continued. I have asked Henry Kissinger, as Secretary of State, to stay on and to be the Secretary of State under the new administration. I've known Henry Kissinger for a great many years. I knew him before he came with the Nixon administration. I want him to be my Secretary of State, and I'm glad to announce that he will be the Secretary of State. Which means that he and I will be working together in the pursuit of peace in the future as we have achieved it in the past. We have many other problems. We have problems at home which must be resolved. And they can be resolved and will be resolved by the cooperation of the Congress with the President and those that work with him. I've been very fortunate in my lifetime in public office to have a good many adversaries in the political arena in the Congress. But I don't think I have a single enemy in the Congress. And the net result is that I think tomorrow I can start out working with Democrats and with Republicans in the House as well as in the Senate to work on the problems, serious ones, which we have at home. And the spirit of cooperation, which I believe will be exhibited with the Congress and the new president on the problems overseas and the problems at home, will be beneficial not only to 211 fine million Americans, but to the world as a whole. And I pledge to you tonight, as I will pledge tomorrow and in the future, my best in cooperation, leadership, and dedication to what's good for America and good for the world. Thank you very much.
So Gerald Ford, about to become the 38th President of the United States, has already taken an important step in what will be the Ford administration. The announcement reassured the nations abroad that Secretary of State Henry Kissinger will stay on and they will work together for the cause of peace. Leslie Stahl, you're there outside the Vice President's house in Alexandria, Virginia. You carry on. Leslie Stahl, can you hear me? Well, the miracles of broadcast media seem to have ceased at this point. We did bring you in by the Vice President, Gerald Ford, with his informal remarks outside his house in Alexandria. We are getting many other comments now as these in these moments after the president's speech, one from a very important key figure in this entire process of these past few days, the Republican leader of the House, John Rhodes of Arizona. It was Rhodes, you remember, after the disclosures on Monday, who said he thought the president should resign, who went to the White House last night with two other Republican leaders and told the president of the mood of the Congress. And now from Rhodes tonight, these comments.
The president of the United States, I think, showed himself to be a true champion as he ended his career as president of the United States. I think he was doing his very best to bring the country back together. He admitted that he had made mistakes. He also said that he had no rancor toward anybody. He thanked those who supported him and said to those who didn't that he understood. I really don't see how it could have been a better speech for the future of the United States of America and for the beginning of a new administration.
Mr. Rhodes, you've been coming up and sitting in that chair as long as I can remember and sitting beside Gerry Ford, and you know him as well as anyone. Would you please tell the American people what sort of man their new president is?
Well, I wish I had more time, but suffice it to say, Gerry Ford is many things. He's a good man. He's a man who believes in God. He's a man who believes in himself and his friends. He's a man with high moral standards. And he's a man who has a burning desire to make this country the greatest country possible. He's a man who wants peace in the world. He's a man who wants the best life possible for every one of the American people. And I think he'll make a great president.
And so there, Reed Collins and Charles Osgood, you have the transition, the comments of Republican leader of the House, John Rhodes, on the speech by the outgoing president and his comments on the incoming president.
And we shall be staying with the presidential resignation story into this evening. We'll be updating it, reporting new developments and reaction to it, and, of course, to the incoming president.
We'll be profiling both Mr. Nixon and Mr. Ford and looking at the future for both men as it appears from this vantage point. Our bureaus and CBS stations around the country will give the reactions of your fellow citizens to the momentous events before us. And CBS News Abroad will tell us about the reaction around the world. And in Washington, Neil Strausser, you'll be remaining on deck and on top of all the developments there at the White House and Congress or wherever, as they happen with the aid of our CBS News correspondents at every key point in the Capitol for our continuing coverage of the resignation of President Nixon. I'm Charles Osgood with Reed Collins. One comment that has come forward tonight is from Special Watergate Prosecutor Leon Jaworski, who says that no agreement or understanding has been made between the president and the special prosecutor. He says that the president asked for no special arrangement and none was offered to him. Of course, this is a matter of some interest because it means that the prosecutor, Leon Jaworski, is free to proceed, at least he is as of this hour, with any prosecutions against the president. Once the resignation takes effect tomorrow at noon, Jaworski did not say tonight one way or the other whether that is his intention.
No, I think, Charles, he felt it incumbent, though, to answer at least some of the questions, at least to negate some of the possibilities that have been bruited about. To recap, within the past 50 minutes in these United States, one president, the 37th, noting that he had spoken 37 times from the Oval Office to the people, told all those people that he's quitting as of noon tomorrow, saying he would like to have completed the term, felt that his political base in Congress obviously had eroded to the point where he simply could not, and therefore Mr. Nixon said he's stepping down, and Vice President Ford is in that same Oval Office at noon tomorrow to take the oath of office. We still don't know precisely legally and constitutionally, Charles, when the president becomes the former president and when Mr. Ford becomes the president, for the simple reason that this transaction is supposed to take place when a letter reaches the Secretary of State, is in his hands, notifying him that the current president no longer wishes to be so.
We haven't seen, of course, the instrument of resignation as yet, which, as you say, is a letter to the Secretary of State.
Henry Kissinger has one of those. He got one about 10 months back, I believe, from Vice President Agnew, so this will be the second sort of thing brought, presumably hand-delivered, tomorrow sometime.
I would imagine that either will be delivered at the stroke of noon, or the reference to time will be contained in the letter that as of 12 noon on the 10th of August, I, Richard Nixon, resigned my office as President of the United States.
Reed and Charles, the legal opinion at the State Department when this unprecedented situation was that at the time the letter, if it did not set a time of resignation, but simply resigned immediately, at the time the letter reached the Secretary of State's office, not even his own hands. The presidency changed hands at that point. But this situation is unprecedented, and this time, for the first time, we have the kind of letter that presumably will state a time when he leaves office. So it probably doesn't matter when it's delivered to the Secretary of State as long as it reaches him by noon Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow.
Well, Neil, you know, a man with whom Mr. Nixon has had a great deal of correspondence and through which he fought one unsuccessful reach for the presidency, listened along with everybody else this evening to that 15-minute, 15-second resignation address. I speak, of course, of Mr. Nixon's one-time running mate, Henry Cabot Lodge, who feels the president has presented himself in good form.
The tone was very good. There isn't any doubt that the events which brought about his departure are tragic and saddening for all of us. But it's also true that he leaves behind him accomplishment in the field of foreign affairs, which I think is very real. The Constitution has worked well. It has enabled us to handle this problem, which in many countries leads to violence, and which in this country, thanks to the Constitution and thanks to our ability to use it, have brought about an orderly change.
Lodge, the former ambassador to the United Nations, also had some high praise for Gerald Ford, calling the next president stable and able. Charles.
Members of Gerald Ford's family watched President Nixon's speech tonight in Grand Rapids, Michigan. CBS News correspondent Ike Pappas asked the vice president's brother, Tom Ford, how he feels now that Gerald Ford will be assuming the office of president tomorrow.
It's frightening. It's frightening because if the public doesn't get behind and get off the negative thinking, we're going to continue to drift. And I'm positive of Jerry's ability to lead if we'll get off negativism and get on some positive things about what's good. And I think Jerry can get along that line if the public will answer with their prayers and their help.
Dr. Ford, knowing your brother as you do, what kind of a president do you think he'll make?
Well, first of all, I'm very proud of Jerry. I think he'll be very conscientious. I think he'll give 100% all the way.
Mrs. Janet Ford, who's Tom's wife. Mrs. Ford, you've had a very hectic 48 hours. I wonder if you could describe what's happened to the family in the past.
I don't think you have that much time. It's a very hectic day, it's true. But it's one that everyone has to do a job, and we appreciate all the work that the press does and that the news media do, and it's a difficult job for them. And I take my hat off to them because you've done a superb job.
That's Janet Ford, Gerald Ford's sister-in-law, and her husband Tom Ford, speaking tonight in Grand Rapids, Michigan. Neil?
Here in Washington, we've had comment now from House Speaker Carl Albert, who, of course, was among the bipartisan leaders of the Congress who met with the president about an hour before he delivered his speech. Speaker Albert was asked about the reasons behind Mr. Nixon's decision to resign, and he answered much as did Mr. Nixon, who said that he had lost his base of support in Congress. Albert said the pro-impeachment margin in the Congress had just grown too large.
The margin grew by yesterday to astounding proportions, and they grew because the president had not come clean about a certain conversation that took place about 10 months before he said he knew anything about it. But that is a part of history, and the president is going out. What I liked about it was not what he did or the things that caused him to leave his office, but it was that he went out not trying to say that he was framed, as some people said he would do. He did not do that. And I think he did a service for the nation in not doing that. I think his speech was complete was more than conciliatory. I think it was a call to the nation.
So there's general praise for the speech from House Speaker Carl Albert. There is, on the other hand, a statement from Democratic Representative Wright Patman of Texas, who says that the nation should learn something from the anguish and pain of the past 2 years, and said, for one thing, that all the facts should be in the public record about Watergate. And, for instance, he called for the release of all those tapes that are being turned over to Judge Sirica so the public can see all the transcripts. I think we're ready now with Leslie Stahl at the home of Vice President Ford. Leslie, are you there?
Yes, I'm here, Neil, finally. The applause you heard as the Vice President came out of his home here in Alexandria, Virginia, came from a large group of his neighbors who've gathered here very enthusiastically to support him and show them that they are pleased with this obvious transition of power. He was smiling, he looked relaxed, and he gave his remarks were off the cuff. And as you heard, he said that he was going to ask Henry Kissinger to stay on as Secretary of State. His press aide has been briefing reporters here now. He says that the swearing-in ceremony will take place at 12 noon tomorrow in the Rose Garden, that is, if the weather holds up. It has been raining here all day. If not, in the East Room in the White House. Chief Justice Warren Burger will officiate, and he has been called back from a three-week vacation. He was planning to take an Amsterdam. I understand he's either en route tonight or will be flying in tomorrow. There have been stories that the Vice President will address a joint session of Congress tomorrow. His press secretary is telling us that he knows nothing about it. It sounds as though they have not made a final decision on that. The scene here, Neil, is one of excitement from Mr. Ford's neighbors. There were dogs barking while he was speaking. There's an ice cream truck around the corner. The bell was going off while the Vice President was speaking. Generally, his friends are here to support him outside. He has gone back in the house. He came home tonight at about 8:25 and watched the President's speech with his wife and two of his four children, Susan, who's 17, and Steve, who's 18, and his other two children, we are told, are en route home right now. His press aide could not tell us when and how the Vice President will White House, but as of tomorrow at noon, he will take over in the Oval Office anyway for business purposes.
Leslie, yep. In the middle of all that excitement, the least excited person seemed to be the Vice President.
Well, I have to be frank with you, Neil, and tell you that I couldn't see him from where I was standing. The crowd, his neighbors, moved in, and I was standing behind three or four people and could not see his face. He sounded relaxed, and as I said, they were off-the-cuff remarks, but I could not see his face.
One of his strengths, of course, is going to be that he has many friends in the Congress from his long service there on both sides of the aisle. And a little earlier this evening, CBS News interviewed two of his Democratic friends in the House. One of them, Representative Don Riegel of Michigan.
Jerry is a kind person. I don't think it's part of his makeup to be someone who could be vindictive or mean-spirited or mm-hmm. or cruel. I mean, he's just not that kind of person. And I think not only was he willing to listen to different points of view, but I think he went out of his way to protect, if you will, dissenters within the Republican Party.
And another one of his Democratic friends, Representative Martha Griffiths of Michigan.
He is going to listen to what is happening to the people in the country, and he is going to pay attention to the economic situation in the country. He will understand it. He will be willing to be briefed in case the pound floats or the lira is in trouble.
So it is clear that he starts with goodwill, Gerald Ford does, from both sides of the aisle in the Congress, and will listen. And we'll stop for 5 seconds for station identification.
At 1080 on the dial, you're listening to KRLD Dallas.
This is Neil Strauser, CBS News Washington, with a host of our other CBS News correspondents around this capital and around the nation. Leslie Stahl at Vice President Ford's house, Robert Pierpoint at the White House. In New York, Charles Osgood and Reed Collins and many others will be calling in from time to time as we cover this story of the many years that I have been in Washington, certainly. The resignation of President Nixon. He has announced he will resign effective noon Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow, and that Vice President J.
Gerald Ford will take the oath of office then as the 38th President of the United States. That announcement by Mr. Nixon came just about 58 minutes ago now, shortly after he began his address to the nation, and here were his words.
To continue to fight through the months ahead for my personal vindication would almost totally absorb the time and attention of both the President and the Congress in a period when our entire focus should be on the great issues of peace abroad and prosperity without inflation at home. Therefore, I shall resign the presidency effective at noon tomorrow.
Mr. Nixon, of course, had explained before that that he felt he no longer had a strong enough political base in the Congress to carry on, and that without that base, he felt the constitutional process had been served, and there was no need to carry through with the process of impeachment, the vote by the House, and the trial by the Senate, although Mr. Nixon, up until this week, had been saying that he wanted the constitutional process to go ahead. In New York, Reed Collins, Charles Osgood.
I was going to say that the president points there to a very interesting fact, which is that the agenda for the Congress and also for the president now suddenly becomes totally changed. It looked as if the House was going to be preoccupied pretty much exclusively for the next month or so with the debate and consideration of the impeachment articles that had been passed by the House Judiciary Committee. And the Senate was making rules and preparing itself for what promised to be a long ordeal of a trial of the president. Now those things are no longer to be necessary, and both houses of Congress can devote themselves, as President Nixon had once put it, to going on with the business of the country. And Vice President Ford, once he becomes president and has adjusted to his new office, acclimated himself to it, can do likewise. He can devote himself to going ahead with a very, very full agenda of problems worldwide and domestic that call for his attention.
Charles, let's remind ourselves there's another matter which must become the business of the Congress now. Mr. Ford, who did appear to make some informal remarks himself that we've heard within the past hour, and said that Mr. Nixon made one of the greatest personal sacrifices for the country, and who also announced that Secretary of State Henry Kissinger would stay on in the Ford administration. Mr. Ford, under the 25th Amendment, now has the duty of naming a vice president, which will make the unique situation, incidentally, of having men in the presidency and the vice presidency who were not, neither one, elected nationwide. Mm-hmm. And that selection he makes will have to be approved by a majority of vote in each House of the Congress, as was the case with Ford himself after Spiro Agnew resigned.
Well, I think it was interesting that he put the stopper in quickly as far as foreign affairs are concerned, and made it plain, Neil, that he's going to keep things running pretty much the way they are without tacking or changing course there. And I'm sure that domestically, and particularly with regard to domestic economics, is going to be the area in which both the incoming president and now the resting Congress can turn its wheels to as soon as they both get a little time of adjustment to one another.
It seems clear that his aim will be reassurance or in the foreign policy field, and I would say unifying the nation on the domestic side. That is why I think his choice of a vice president will be most interesting. We've had a whole list of names in the speculation, supposedly 14 names drawn up for him by his aides. Topping that list, and much of the speculation, of course, is Governor Nelson Rockefeller, the former governor of New York, who would, however, arouse some opposition in the more conservative wing of the Republican Party.
Neil, one of the men that has been very close to Gerry Ford all of the years that he's been in Congress, and many of the insiders believe is probably going to be offered the job of vice president, although it may be more or less a pro forma offer, is Melvin Laird, the former Secretary of Defense. Mr. Laird, as you know, has been very active behind the scenes in many of these processes of the past year. He came briefly to the White House when it became clear that Watergate was a serious threat to the presidency.
Two points before in the unifying process.
That's right, exactly.
After the resignations of H.R. Haldeman and John Ehrlichman.
And he tried very hard, I think, to save Richard Nixon from the fate that seems to have become inevitable. Finally, he realized he wasn't really accomplishing anything. He was isolated, kept away from Mr. Nixon. So he left that staff job here. But he has still been in close touch with the administration and with the members of Congress. And in fact, in the past week, I understand that he has been active in trying to smooth the path of transition. And with that background, there is some strong feeling that Mr. Ford may offer his close friend Melvin Laird the vice presidency. And there's some question as to whether Laird really wants the job, but my guess is that he should stand high on that list of probables.
Of course, a change in the presidency of the United States affects people not only in the United States, but all over the world. And in cities around the world, people receive the news in various ways. Here in New York City, people gathered in Times Square to hear the president's speech, and WCBS reporter Art Athens was there.
In Times Square, New Yorkers gather, but not in great numbers. They gather around portable radios, quietly and not reveling. They listen to the President of the United States making his resignation speech. But Times Square is really quiet tonight. How do you feel about it?
It's become evident to me.
I think it stinks. I think it's all rotten. I don't think it makes a difference, you know? They're giving you a bone, handing you a bone and saying, be satisfied with this when you shouldn't be satisfied with it. You know, it really doesn't make a difference whether Nixon is president or whether Ford is president. It makes no difference whatsoever.
I feel that I feel sad about it, but one way it had to be done. And one feeling of mine is, will Gerald Ford be the right man for the office, since he'll be the first president ever elected, not elected by the people, appointed.
Producer, how do you feel about the resignation?
Well, I feel it's long overdue. However, I regret the fact that it's left us vulnerable to any enemies that we might have. And I hope that this new administration gets together real fast and gets us on a solid track.
Here in Times Square, most people are not too happy that the President of the United States is stepping down, even though many feel they wanted him to. Art Athens for CBS News in New York.
Well, that's a little flavor of the Times Square thing, Charles. I don't suppose we would expect people to be out, as they sometimes are wont to do on a New Year's, to watch the presidency come down in some Flatiron Tower someplace. It isn't really quite that sort of an event.
It's funny, people do seem to gather at events like this, and it's not because they really can expect to see anything. People have been gathering for the past couple of days out in front of the White House, as if almost they expected that there would be some visible sign when this thing took place. Of course, that isn't the way it works, but I think maybe people seek out each other's company and try to get out into crowds on an occasion such as this. It's just some instinct deep within all of us, I believe.
May well be. Let's get some of our first foreign reaction to the formality of the event as we now know it to be. In Tel Aviv, Bruno Wassertile is standing by. Bruno, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Reed.
Is there any official governmental reaction to, say, the fact that Ford is definitely going to keep Secretary Kissinger on as Secretary of State?
There is no official reaction, mainly because it's 5 a.m. in the morning here in Israel, and it's doubtful whether there will be some official reaction till Israel actually wakes up. There's satisfaction in Israel since Vice President Ford already made it plain that he would retain Secretary Kissinger as his chief Department of State man, and the foreign policy that the United States has followed thus far will probably be continued.
Bruno, what about, is there any reaction since it's 5 a.m., as you say, in the morning
Hello.
In Tel Aviv?
Hello.
I can hardly hear you. I think we're having the same problem Washington is getting to Alexandria, Virginia.
Hello. I'm sorry, Reed. Can you repeat that, please?
I was wondering, has there been any reaction at all, or was the thing, as it has been here, well known in advance?
I'm sorry, Reed, we cut out, but I assume your question, whether there has been any reaction at all, or... a surprise. It came as no surprise to the Israelis. And the last parts of the scenario were pretty well known. It was just a matter of time before Watergate engulfed the president. Though the drama of the final moments of President Nixon as President of the United States, to the drama of the moment, and of course surpassed any local news, even the tension on the Syrian front.
And that's the situation as we get it from Tel Aviv, Israel. Bob Pierpont in Washington, how are things shaping up there? Any reaction coming in? Any thoughts?
Well, first of all, I think it's worth pointing out that President Nixon, as he delivered his address from the Oval Office, did not have his family in the room with him. It had been thought originally that they would be there, but instead they watched from the private quarters of the mansion. And, in fact, just before the president went on the air, he even asked the Secret Service men who normally guard him to please leave the room. He was told that one should stay, and there was some discussion about it, and we're not yet absolutely positive that anyone else in the room was there except the technicians who happened to be CBS employees who were in the room when he delivered the address. So the president, in effect, was alone with the American people. Now, around the White House here itself, obviously there's a somber mood. Many of his aides and members of his staff were huddled around television sets watching, others carrying radios and listening as they moved. And outside the White House, there was an interesting development in the beginning. Well, I think the thing to do perhaps is to have my colleague Connie Chung describe what's been happening outside the White House as she has been in and around this dramatic scene.
There are several hundred young people outside the White House on the Pennsylvania side, Pennsylvania Avenue side. They're standing around Lafayette Park, which is just across the street from the White House, partially because of the television cameras, but also they have come out with firecrackers and sparklers, and they're chanting and shouting their approval of the president's resignation. Many of them are standing in the middle of the street, causing extreme traffic jams on Pennsylvania Avenue right in front of the White House, and there are several people on the very side of the White House peering into the fence, watching and looking, trying to see what is going on inside.
Connie, that is quite a change, because initially, during much of the day today, there's been a very somber atmosphere outside the White House. And not only that, but in fact, there have been a sizable number of the president's supporters out there carrying signs, singing songs like We Shall Overcome, and trying to convince themselves that the president would stay in office and trying to convince him not to resign. Now, if I understand you correctly, there's almost a celebration by another group over the fact that he has said he will resign. Is that the way the situation has gone?
That's correct. There's one group, the group that I was speaking of with the sparklers, and the other group is directly in front of the White House, and that group, of course, has been singing nearly all night long in support of the president, earlier asking him not to resign before he gave his speech.
We hope these two groups don't get too close together. We might have a different kind of fireworks out there. Connie, you have also been talking to some of the members of Congress who've been here at the White House. Could you report on that for us?
Yes, several members of Congress, both senators and congressmen, described as close friends of the president, handpicked, met with the president for about a half an hour before he gave his speech. He spoke with them for approximately 25 minutes, I'm told. Congressman Sam Devine, a Republican of Ohio, he's a member of the leadership in the House. He's vice chairman of the Republican Conference, and he's been in Congress for 16 years, said that the president choked up a couple of times as he spoke to the congressmen and senators. He spoke in the cabinet room and said this is the last time he will be in that room, his last speech. Congressman Devine also said that as soon as the president entered the room, everyone stood up and applauded him, and he asked that everyone join him in this tough occasion, and that everyone bear with him. Another congressman that I spoke with was Representative G.B. Sonny Montgomery, a Democrat of Mississippi, a man who supported the president, a man who said that the president was not guilty of any impeachable offenses until now. He resigns to the fact that he thought that perhaps the president should have resigned. Congressman Montgomery said that the president talked about ending the Vietnam War. He talked about his trips to Russia and to China and his accomplishments in the Middle East as in addition to domestic matters. And he thanked everyone for their friendship and support. And he said that he hoped that he hadn't let them down.
Thank you, Connie Chung. Perhaps you will go back outside and find out what is happening between the two groups outside the White House. Make sure that peace prevails out there and keep us posted while those of us with CBS News around the country at our various listening posts perhaps talk a little about the future now. Neil?
Well, of course, the future is Gerald Ford, who will be taking over at noon Eastern Daylight Time tomorrow. And Reed Collins, I think you have some thoughts on that.
Well, we have some thoughts about the subject that we have sort of nibbled about the edges of, and this is the task that remains before incoming President Ford to find another like he was and is today. Bob Schieffer has talked with our CBS News legal correspondent Fred Graham about the power of the presidency and about what a President Ford is going to have to do regarding the selection of his vice president.
Fred Graham, let me just ask you first, under the 25th Amendment, what happens next?
Well, right away, President Ford will send the name of his person, his nominee, to be vice president to Congress. And very quickly there will be hearings and a vote, and if that's approved by a majority vote of both houses, then that person becomes Vice President of the United States.
And that goes through the same procedures under which the President selected Mr. Ford, under which President Nixon selected Mr. Ford to be Vice President when there was a vacancy. We just do that all over again.
That's right. Of course, he was the first person to ever become Vice President under the 25th Amendment. It's relatively new, 2 or 3 years old, I guess.
In a way, Richard Nixon played a role in, or at least was one of the reasons that the Congress came to feel that a 25th Amendment would be necessary.
Yes, Bob, I was chief counsel of the Senate Constitutional Amendment Subcommittee when that was first came under consideration, and I wrote then private citizen Richard Nixon, asked him to testify in the hearings. He didn't do that, but he referred us to his book, Six Crises, and then sent us written testimony, which went in the record and did contribute to the enactment of the 25th Amendment. It's rather ironic.
And, of course, when President Eisenhower was incapacitated for a time because of illness, Richard Nixon, as vice president, sort of served as an unofficial vice president.
That's right. He served
as an unofficial president, I should say.
Well, he served actually as an unofficial acting president, but there was no procedure then to make it official. Now, under the 25th Amendment, if Ford were to be in any way incapacitated once he gets his new vice president, then he could act as acting president officially.
And who becomes acting president if by some chance something should happen to President Ford before a vice president is elected?
Well, there's a statute that sets out the line of succession, and the next person would be the Speaker of the House, Carl Albert, and then the President pro tem of the Senate. Then it runs right through the cabinet members, starting with the Secretary of State, and right on down in their normal succession of protocol.
Let me ask you this, Fred. Does the Constitution also say that a person can only serve as president 10 years? So does this mean that Mr. Ford, assuming, or if he is elected in his own right in 1976, if he chooses to run, would he be eligible to run again then in 1980?
Well, Bob, another one of the ironies of this situation is that he is the first person to fall under a certain provision of the 22nd Amendment. You'll know that was passed when some of the people who disapproved of President Roosevelt's long tenure in the White House passed the 22nd Amendment, which says that no person can be elected more than twice as president. And he can't be elected, he can't serve but one term and 2 years of a prior term if he happens to become president by resignation or by the death of the president. And that means that he can only be reelected once under the 22nd Amendment. He will have been president only 6.5 years if he gets reelected, where any other person could have served two full 4-year terms.
Fred, in your opinion, has all of this, all of what has happened, damaged the presidency?
Well, you know, that was really the bedrock of former President Nixon's defense during the Watergate controversy. He said over and over that the presidency was threatened with erosion, primarily because of the rejection by the courts of executive privilege. But I always thought that actually the facts so disputed that, the legal facts, that one of the reasons why that argument was rejected was that in the courts there were a series of cases challenging overreaching or alleged overreaching by the president, not just President Nixon, but it happened in prior presidents. Impoundment of funds, over and over again claiming inherent power to take acts, alleged abuse of the pocket veto and such. And it appeared to me that most observers in this community felt that the presidency, if anything, had become too powerful with regard to the courts and to the Congress. And we had a condition in the last two or three years where senators and congressmen were going into the courts and suing the president. That's never really happened that way in this country before. Number of suits in which the plaintiffs were members of Congress suing the president. And I think the reason that those arguments didn't carry the day was that there was an instinctive feeling in the Capitol that the presidency, if anything, was too strong. And I think now, with no derogation at all to Gerald Ford, people will be happy to see a little more balance with regard to those three branches.
So perhaps in some ways it may really strengthen things. Would you agree with that, in that it does seem to demonstrate that the system works?
Yes, the system, as I said, it was interesting the way the courts and Congress suddenly were allies against the presidency. You know, there had been a long period in which Congress had been sort of the know-nothing element in this town, or allegedly so. Congress was forever trying to investigate someone on the grounds that they were communists or radicals, and Congress was passing harsh laws to crack down on criminal suspects, and the executive branch would usually take the side of the courts. That swung around in the last couple of years, and because there was, it seemed to be, a lack of balance. Now, perhaps the three branches will be more in balance.
Fred Graham, thank you very much.
Our legal correspondent, Fred Graham, in discussion with CBS News correspondent Bob Schieffer, and our thanks to you both. Charlie Osgood, maybe you could catch us up now on what we've been discussing this night.
Well, in the event that anyone wonders why all this discussion, if you've been out of touch for a while, the big news of the night is that President Nixon, in a radio and television speech to the nation from the Oval Office at the White House an hour and 25 minutes ago, announced that he is resigning the presidency effective 12 noon tomorrow, at which time Gerald Ford, now the vice president, will be sworn in as the 38th president of the United States. President Nixon will be leaving Washington before that time. He'll be leaving tomorrow for California. By the time his plane gets to the coast, he will be a private citizen. Now again to Washington and Neil Strausser.
With me here in our Washington studio is CBS News correspondent Bruce Morton, who's covered the impeachment story from its inception on the House side, who has tonight heard the president declare his intention of resigning, and who has since been seeking reaction. Bruce?
Well, the people whom I've talked to this evening, Neil, have by and large liked the speech. They thought it was gentle and magnanimous, leaving on a graceful note. Mr. Nixon did not in the speech address himself to any of the things that were, either of the things, I should say, that were worrying the Congress today. The question of what becomes of the impeachment process, or the question of immunity. And in those areas, the reaction, because he didn't really go to either of those subjects, remains pretty much unchanged. Carl Albert has been saying all day that he doesn't think the impeachment process needs to go any further, that the Judiciary Committee ought to finish its report, lay out the case on the record, but there's no point in a vote, no point in a formal impeachment, consequently no point in a Senate trial. Sentiment in the Senate and House seemed to be weighted before the president spoke against the idea of the Congress, at least, trying to do anything about immunity for him, and that remains true. Republicans, I think, would generally say that it's going to be a little easier to campaign this fall. They and a number of Democrats think this really removes Watergate as an issue. In other words, a freshman Republican running for Congress in the 12th District and wherever doesn't have to worry that his opponent is going to ignore him and run against Richard Nixon and Watergate. That's down the drain now. Gerald Ford assumes the presidency as Mr. Clean, and that's a help.
One of those you talked to tonight, was it Rogers Morton?
Mm-hmm. Yes.
The Secretary of the Interior. There's a feeling that he may play an increasingly important role in a Ford administration. Did he give any indication of that tonight?
He said he talked to Vice President Ford today, that the Vice President had asked him to stay on in the cabinet, and that he would, that he would be happy, as anybody would, to undertake any additional jobs that were offered, any additional responsibilities. And he had the feeling that I think, although I haven't talked to him, is general among cabinet members, that this is likely to be a more cabinet-y administration than President Nixon's was. Less reliance on White House staff, more reliance on the men who are supposed to be in charge of the departments. The phrase he used was, this is going to be an exciting time for the cabinet.
The feeling was, among those informed observers during this day, that there would be a more open administration, was the phrase being used.
Well, I think so. That's Ford's whole tradition. He comes from the Congress. He's used to being buttonholed by colleagues in the House, by reporters in the Speaker's lobby, and he's used to talking to them when they tug at his shoulder and say, hey, wait a minute.
We recall that when he was first nominated to be Vice President, he made an appearance in the House radio gallery and said, if you will let me, I'll come back quite often, word to that effect.
Mm-hmm.
And he's been very approachable as Vice President.
Yes, I would look for more news conferences. I'd look for more contacts, not just with reporters. I think we sometimes think that we're the only people who are involved in openness, and that's not true. But more appointments with people outside, more contacts with folks, with reporters, with government officials who aren't on the White House staff, just a wider range generally.
Bruce Morton, thank you very much. And back in New York, Reed Collins, Charles Osgood.
We're here, and we were reading just another statement that we mentioned. One of the senators some time back, a congressman who had to, or felt he had to sue the chief executive to get congressional business done. And Senator Kennedy, the Democrat of Massachusetts.
So far it seems, Reed, as if virtually all of the reaction to what the president has said has been in the same spirit that the president's own statement was, and that is in the Lincolnian spirit of malice toward none and charity toward all. There really has been no bitterness. We've heard nobody say he had it coming or anything of that kind. In California, Governor Ronald Reagan, who has long himself been considered a presidential prospect, talked with reporters about the resignation of Mr. Nixon.
I think the president made the right decision for the country. I think when finally it became apparent that the outcome of such an impeachment would be a foregone conclusion, I then, as someone editorialized the other day, to go through the process simply for the sake of going through it didn't make much sense.
Governor Ronald Reagan of California. Reed?
The Reverend Dr. Carl McIntyre, a fundamentalist preacher and formerly an ardent Nixon supporter, has said that he's disappointed in the speech because the president did not ask the nation, he says, for forgiveness.
It was not what we expected or what we should have had. There was no sense of shame or guilt or humiliation on his part. He didn't ask the American people to forgive him. I feel that he actually insulted the moral conscience of this great nation, which was expressing itself in the Congress and which forced him to his action.
The Reverend Dr. Carl McIntyre, who has in the past at least been a former supporter of President Nixon.
Many, if not most, Americans watched or listened to President Nixon's speech tonight. In San Francisco, CBS News correspondent Richard Threlkeld asked people in the street how they felt about Richard Nixon's resignation.
Mr. Nixon seemed to say that he wanted to heal the wounds of the country. Did you get that impression of the speech? Was it a kind of conciliatory speech?
I would say so. I'd say he was rather sincere. I feel that way. To me, it's an American tragedy.
In what way?
Well, whether you're Republican or Democrat, it's a tragic turn of events that this happened. It's like somebody in the family, not that I support him or don't support him, but somebody in the family, it's our president, it's your president, it's my president. It's just a tragic affair.
You feel sad at what he did. Do you feel happy now that he is out?
I don't think it's something you feel happy over. I'm glad he's not the president. I'm not happy that he had to resign or jubilant about the situation.
Have you been able to cope with all the developments today? You've seen the speech. You knew it was coming. What's your own feeling?
Well, I think, first of all, I think I'm kind of
well, I guess taken in by, overtaken by the whole thing. I think that it was a sad turn of events that he had to resign, and personally I think that the speech tonight was adequate as far as the Senate, the leaders in the Senate that wanted him to admit guilt and so forth. I don't think that that would have served any purpose. I think that by judging personally the way I feel and the way that I think the other people felt, by the sighs of relief that were let off when he did say that he was resigning, I think that that was totally adequate.
CBS News correspondent Dick Threlkeld with reactions from some people on the streets of San Francisco.
And so we've been discussing the resignation of the president who made his will and wishes known an hour and a half ago in a speech to the country. Took him just 15 minutes to complete the address. It took him only 60 seconds at the top to tell us what he intended to do, which was resign the office of president at noon tomorrow Eastern Time, at which time the president-designate, the vice president, Gerald Ford, will take the oath of office there in the Oval Office, and he will become number 38. And it's as simple as that, Charles. It seems to me that the great weight of the moment has sort of escaped us in the relative simplicity and grace with which it all really happened. Neil Strausser?
We have one of our Republicans in the Senate looking ahead a bit to the political future. I'm sure you have noticed the comments of Senator Edward Brooke of Massachusetts, who was one of the first Republicans to call for the resignation of Mr. Nixon, who now is looking at Gerald Ford and saying if Ford is able to curb inflation and improve the economy, and if he continues the Nixon-Kissinger foreign policy, Brooks says, and we quote, no Democrat will be able to defeat him in 1976 because the country will be so grateful. We have a comment also from a member of the House Judiciary Committee, which, as you recall, last week completed its work on three proposed articles of impeachment. This is Brooks, not Brooke, Jack Brooks of Texas. And here's what he said about Mr. Nixon's resignation, an announcement of plans to resign tonight.
It's my feeling, as one of the most ardent believers in the impeachment, that removal from office is the basic requirement of impeachment and the basic penalty. I think that he has resigned. I think that nobody really in the Congress on serious thought wants to make his burden any greater than necessary. I think that the report of the committee, the drafts of which will be ready in the morning for the committee members, some of the Democrats are working on it now, and the Republicans and the people that have supported it, all of them now have indicated some support on the committee. I think that report must be accepted in some fashion by the House of Representatives so that it can become a document which lays out what the basis was for the Congress and for the committee's actions.
That was Jack Brooks, Democratic member from Texas of the House Judiciary Committee. With us in our studio right now, the Secretary of the Interior, Rogers Morton. Secretary, we understand you are going to stay on in the Ford administration.
Yes, I have been privileged to have been asked by, I guess, President Ford does tomorrow, Vice President Ford, if I would stay on, and I'm delighted to serve in any way I can.
Let me take you back one moment and ask for your comments on Mr. Nixon's speech tonight.
Well, of course, for me, it was a sad time. It was a great privilege for me to serve in the Nixon cabinet, and I know that the whole events of Watergate overrode and overlaid the other activities of the government, many of which I was very proud. I thought we were doing a good job in many areas, so it was a sad occasion for me, but I think that I think he spelled it out as he saw it. I think he was without rancor. He didn't, he seemed to have no bitterness in his heart. And I think there is a contribution that he can make. And so it was a thing that we had to live through. It was historical in every sense of the word.
Do you think, Mr. Secretary, that he committed an impeachable offense?
Well, I guess so, because based on the actions of the Congress, or at least the way it was, but it's a matter of a guess. I don't know what I'm not a lawyer. I was very uncomfortable with it. I felt that the thing was accelerated emotionally and in many cases beyond reason. But I know that the Judiciary Committee of the House worked at this thing and worked at it in good conscience. And I really am not a person to judge on that. I have great affection for Mr. Nixon. I've known him for a long time, and I...